From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue in fully functional bug-free Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Martha Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are extra modes and unit testing. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start. You know, we do these adjectives at the top of the show.
Yes.
To describe the city.
Uh-huh.
And they're usually pretty fantastical.
Uh-huh.
But this, the ones here might have taken the cake.
Yeah. I know a lot about these ones.
Just wishful thinking. Like.
Yeah, maybe. One day we'll be bug-free and fully functional.
Yeah, you do this long enough and you're like, that's a fantasy. It's not
Yeah.
It's not a goal you reach. It's
right.
Just, it's a thing you dream of.
Yep. Yep. Okay, so Martha.
Yes.
Going on a trip.
I know. I'm going to the XOXO festival.
Ooh, I do not know what that is.
It's awesome. It's like an internet festival conference thing. So Okay. They have speakers who are all people who work on internet things. Like this year, there's a bunch of YouTubers and a couple who does game dev on a boat, like a sailboat in the middle of the ocean. They seem really awesome.
Yeah.
There's also like going to be a mortician who's talking about how she's trying to make like burying people a greener process and is like campaigning on the internet for that. Cause like, she's like, we bury so much like precious metals and things that we need and also poison and like formaldehyde or whatever. So that will be super interesting. And then they also have the festival part, which has like video. There's gonna be an arcade, so indie video games will be there. Okay. There's a board game tabletop section, and I think Root from the Twin Cities is gonna be there. Leader Games is on the list, so that'll be cool. Last year Lizzo played a concert there.
Really?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, last year is the reason I was following the whole thing on Twitter last year, which is why I wanted to go because like Ryan North was there last year and like all these people I know. So this year there aren't as many people I know, but because I know their past like pedigree of people that they've invited, like I'm really excited to find out about all these new people that I haven't heard of because they're going to be probably just as cool.
Yeah.
So, yes, I'm very excited for that. Also, someone who's going to be there is Gretchen McCulloch, who I wanted to plug. Her book is coming out soon. She's an internet linguist who I know. She's like an acquaintance through linguistics conferences that I've been to. And her book is called Because Internet, Understanding the New Rules of Language. And I thought our listeners might be interested in it because it's all about grammar of the internet. Like, what does it mean when you frame your text, like form your texts a certain way? Or what does it mean when you like, why do old people text that way? Or like, why are memes so popular? And how like when you see one that's wrong, like it's not formed correctly. Why do you know that? Like, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And it just sounds really awesome. And so if you want to pre-order that's available for pre-order right now and will come out in July.
Ah, cool.
So anyway, I just think it's really cool. So I wanted to talk about it.
That's awesome. When is the XOXO?
XOXO is in September.
Ah, okay, cool.
So,
and then in order to be able to go, it was like a lottery process, right?
Yeah. So, it's pretty cool. So instead of first comes first serve, you fill out this survey because they wanted the reason they wanted it to be kind of curated who gets to go is because they found that at a lot of these things, companies come to just throw merch at you or try to recruit people. And they're like, this isn't about recruiting people. This is about like learning and, you know, so you have to fill out a thing to be like, yes, I'm not a company. Here's what I do. and then if you're not a company, then they put your name in a lottery and pull out the first 400 and then you get like 48 hours to buy your ticket. And if you don't, then it goes to the next person they draw.
Cool.
So.
Well, awesome. I hope you have a good time.
I know. I will report back on the podcast.
Yeah, sweet. Speaking of things that we're going to later, I'm going to E3 in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I just now realize it's in a couple of weeks. I need to get my things in order. we're going to have an E3 special, like immediately afterwards, to discuss the happenings of E3,
yeah,
like my experience, and also, all of the news that'll happen, because there'll probably be one or two games announced.
Wait, hold up. So immediately afterwards, because we're next time, I'm just trying to do this in my head now, yeah, live okay. on the air. So,
yeah.
Calendar math.
And then we record like the day after, right?
Yeah, a couple or days something? After.
Okay, like so that. Then we'll try to get that episode out right away.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I'm excited for that.
I'm not the one editing that, so I see now what I've done.
Well, sometimes we're timely on events like this. Like, we're like GDC, when we do GDC episodes, we try to like get them out as quick as possible so that they're a little more relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll try that again here with the E3 one, because I think everyone wants to hear what you got up to.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going to see. I'm really hoping. I'm pretty sure they're going to announce a new character for Smash, and I feel like I'm just going to go and spend 4 hours in line so I can play a new character in Smash that like I could just wait a week and play later.
Yeah.
It'll be worth it. I don't know.
How long did they go? Because they announced the first Joker months ago, but only now recently just came out.
Yeah,
right?
Joker came out like a month ago.
Oh, okay.
Joker was announced like 3 months before he actually came out. And they haven't announced any other characters yet. So what a lot of people are suspecting is that they're going to have like a sneak announcement at E3 and release it on that day too.
Oh, sure.
Which, now that I think about it, might be inconvenient because it'll be hard for me to download it while I'm there. But
maybe you shouldn't go.
Yeah, well, I'll just throw away the ticket. No. I'm looking forward to it. It'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking forward to news, any kinds of news, all of the news, because I'll be
there. And we were talking before about how it's like kind of cool having grown up hearing about it, finally getting able to to go.
It was always really a dream of mine to go to E3. I guess I'm fulfilling that. Which is real cool. Yeah.
Awesome.
So, should we start with the topics?
Sure. Martha, got any fun transitions for us?
I was just trying to think. Just a second.
Okay. All right. Pause the show. So, Stephen, while she's doing that, maybe you and I could catch up.
Yeah. How are you doing, Mark?
Okay.
Okay. All right. I know we've been working on Widget Stash. It's getting real close.
It's getting real close. I know we say that all the time, but...
Yeah.
Well, maybe it'll take longer because you have to add an extra mode to the game.
Sweet.
So that's my topic. Extra modes, alternate modes in games. I mean, this is a pretty broad thing, but I kind of want to narrow my thinking of it to... Because there's like a lot of games have like bonus features or... they'll have like I'm thinking of that I don't mean is like in Mortal Kombat there's the like test your might kind of mini game.
Oh, sure.
Or like Street Fighter has one where you beat up a Honda Accord.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Little extras. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
thing. Little things like that, little bonus mini games or things like that. Like that's not really what I mean.
Sure.
I mean more like it's almost like a completely different game as part of the same system.
You're talking like a fully fleshed out mode.
Yeah. So a lot of times this will take the form of like a single player and a multiplayer mode. That's a pretty common way to do it.
Yeah.
First person shooters, I think, have gotten really good at being like, or a lot of them anyway, they're like, they're both, right? They're not one or the other. And then there are many, at least now, more than ever, that are just multiplayer.
Yeah.
There are other games that you wouldn't expect to have that kind of dynamic or that split. And they have these extra modes that seem like totally different games.
Yeah.
And one that really got me thinking of it is the multiplayer mode from Assassin's Creed. They don't do it anymore, but for a couple of years they did this like stealth mode. We had a bunch of assassins in a little square, and you'd all hide in a bunch of hay, and it was like a really good mode. Mm-hmm. But it felt, and it used all the same mechanics and tools that the single player mode did.
Yeah.
But it was an utterly different game. You used different strategies to play. It was completely different, and not just because it was multiplayer, because of like the feeling of it was very different. And so I wanted to talk about that and like how that, what does that mean for certain games?
Sure.
Is that a benefit? Is it sort of like, and the origins of these kinds of things and how they sometimes take over like a franchise as it moves forward or spawn genres or anything like that.
Yeah, that's cool stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, do you have any like examples of games that had maybe smaller alternate modes that became the thing you loved about them, or
Kirby Air Ride?
Yeah.
The racing game with Kirby in it.
I wanted to play that game so badly. I would pretend to play it in Nintendo Power all the time.
It's an amazing game. But like the one mode that like everybody thinks of when they think of Kirby Air Ride, and I guess not a lot of people think of Kirby Air Ride, is City Trial mode.
Yeah.
It was so, you know, Kirby Air Ride is a kart racer. So it was kind of like Mario Kart and stuff, except you didn't have to press the A button to go. You would just automatically move and then just steer. Because Sakurai, when he designs things, he designs it so that, like, for the simple controls, but it's hard to master kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, but what this thing did is, like, you could, everybody was in a city, and, like, you would drive around and, like, find boxes and blow up the boxes, and then you can get, like, equipment that would upgrade your chip's abilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, and you would play, I guess you could play for like 7 minutes. And then so you would do that and you would play it, you know, upgrade your ship for another thing. But you didn't know like what at the end, there's supposed to be an event where you like compete against one another.
So there's a race at the end.
It's not necessarily a race. Sometimes it was like a battle thing. Sometimes it was like.
So it's random every time?
Yes. So like you were preparing for something and you didn't know what you were preparing for.
Oh, cool.
It was like surprisingly.
And the prep exciting. Wasn't the gameplay exactly.
Well, that was like for 7 minutes. That is what you did, is you just went around and gathered a bunch of things.
So you could you'd be like, well, I think it's going to be the battle mode. And you like trick your cart out with like projectiles and like defense stuff.
Well, yeah, more attack and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it turns out to be a race and you're like real slow.
Yeah. That's exactly what would happen. And I mean, like the mini games at the end were really short. They only lasted like a lap of a race or something like that. So like it didn't feel like you were wasting your time during that time picking up all the stuff.
Yeah.
And like random events would happen during the city trial too. Sometimes the character would come in and steal your stuff and you had to go and get it back and things like that. But it was just really cool because it felt like a whole new fleshed out idea and it just hasn't been seen in any other game at all. I think Sakurai tried to put it in Super Smash Brothers for 3DS. Like it was Smash Run or something, and it was fun, but it didn't feel the same.
Yeah,
and I want that back. But that's the kind of thing that I was thinking of. Like when I think of Kirby Air Ride, I think of City Trial.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think like speaking of kart racers, like you know Mario Kart has battle mode.
Oh right, yeah,
and that was I think it was in the original Mario Kart, and it was sort of a new idea then.
Yeah,
and it's always been my favorite mode in Mario Kart. And Mario Kart 8 for Wii U when it first came out didn't have a battle mode.
Not a real
or it did, but you played it while racing on the track, and who needs that noise?
Yeah.
And I remember when that happened, thinking like that makes no sense because Mario Kart is battle mode to me. That's what makes it different from a racing game.
Yeah,
like any other racing game. But like I just looked at it differently from what apparently most people did, because a lot of people lamented its loss. Mm-hmm. For the Wii U, it sold very well, and of course they did add the battle mode back for the Switch version.
Yeah,
thankfully with many variants and so forth. But I remember thinking like, what a crazy mistake to not include that because it's such part of the identity. But apparently that wasn't totally true.
I mean, I was with you there.
Yeah, but that I think that's really interesting. Like, imagine if another Kirby Air Ride type game came out and didn't have that.
Oh man, like it would just be a shame. Be a true shame.
Yeah, and but thinking of when the developers put it together, did they assume that that was going to be part of the character of it, or was it just like an extra thing to increase some content or whatever? Like, that interests me a lot. Is the difference between the developer's intent of like how the game feels versus what people take it as.
Yeah.
Fortnite, for example, was a game about building a fort.
Right.
And it was like a tower defense game in third person shooter mode. That was what that game was. And that's why it's called that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they added this battle royale mode because it wasn't selling great or wasn't doing great. And then most popular game in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's super fascinating. Like how flexible are you when you put these things together?
Yeah, it's definitely something.
So, Overwatch has a bunch of modes that they roll out every, like, they're like events.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And my favorite one is the Halloween event every year because it makes everyone cooperative against AI zombies and stuff that come at you. And then, like, characters that are dressed up as, you know, in Halloween costumes as, like, Dr. Junkenstein and, like, you know, the sorcerer and the witch who brings everyone back and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You only get to pick a subset of four characters that the game has already decided for you. So basically you're just picking a role like if you're going to be support or the one who goes up and shoots people. Mm-hmm. And it's always really fun and everyone's like pretty positive in it. And it's like, I don't know. I love it. It's very fun. It's just, you know, shooting robots.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an interesting twist on that because like it's an extra mode. It's only a timed extra mode.
Right. So there's not enough to for like a meta to form and for like elite players. So the spirit of it is much more in sort of let's get together in the park and throw a frisbee around.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's a pickup game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that being said, like they did that. They could have extra modes and stuff like that for League of Legends back when I used to play it. And like they had one mode called Earth mode.
Earth.
Yeah. Where I think it's altered rapid fire or something like that. And basically it just made it so like all of your characters, their cooldowns were like 20% of what they normally are and things mm-hmm. like that. So everybody could spam all of their things.
Yeah.
Like they kept bringing it back and eventually people just kept picking the same champions that they deemed the most fun. Mm-hmm. And it would almost feel more like a drag to play the game because like people were, you know, exploiting all of the more popular characters.
Yeah.
The more effective characters. And so a meta started forming and it became less fun as a result.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Maybe that will be the case with Overwatch. I hope not, but where like, they have this Halloween mode keep coming back and people start like developing strategies.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I guess it's cooperative, so it's not as big of a deal.
Yeah. And they sometimes change the characters up, but there's only four to pick and everybody can only pick a different, like you all have to be a different one. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could be a jerk and take all the kills from everybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there's so many coming from so many different directions that it's really hard to take everything.
Ultimately, the balance has so few moving parts that it's like almost impossible to exploit. It sounds like everyone is already playing at maximum capacity.
Yes,
right.
Well, that's good.
Huh. Yeah, and a lot of times modes like this that start out as kind of like a lark or sort of a silly a twist,
much too silly.
end up turning into their own thing. And then I think what ends up happening is, you can either have it like it in League where it becomes exploited because they just keep using the same sort of, you know, thing, or it gets developed further into its own game. Yeah. So Battle Royale games all started as modes in other games,
right.
Fan mods and stuff like that.
I mean,
as
MOBAs
well.
Did.
I was going to say MOBAs started out as a fan mod of Warcraft 3, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's a little different from a developer doing that process, but that happens as well. Mm-hmm. So Team Fortress was a mode for Quake, and that's what brought class-based shooters. And then Team Fortress 2 is the sequel to that. And then so commercialized it.
Huh.
And so, and I always find that so strange because I played a ton of Team Fortress mm-hmm. when I was younger.
Yeah.
When I was a lot really young.
Yeah.
And knowing that Team Fortress 2, the sequel to that thing I played when I was like 9 or 10 or whatever, is still like an ongoing concern and is so far removed from like my experience of it. Mm-hmm. And then that birthed games like Overwatch and other hero shooters.
Right.
And even that sort of idea in games about having like class-based, hero-based types of games. And it all came from something that wasn't really the main mode of something else. I think that's really cool. So you have to think if you're as a designer, like how do you want to create those openings? Can you do it on purpose?
Yeah.
Can you make a game and then make a side mode that you intend to become what the sequel is based on or something like that? I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I think it is possible for you to approach an extra mode as like a way to experiment, but not fully dive into like making a new thing.
Yeah.
Like I think with City Trial and Kirby Air Ride, like there's still regular racing, it's regular air ride mode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like Sakurai, like probably and his team decided that like they wanted to put a regular racing mode in for people who, you know, just wanted to play a kart racer. But like added in the City Trial as an extra thing for people who wanted more depth, I guess.
Okay.
More extra stuff.
So do you think that was maybe the the mode that they were playing around the office? Like,
I think that was
intended
what it was.
for the people who really love the game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that's what it was. At least it feels like it. Cause City Trial seems like such a bigger part of the thing, and it encompasses the regular air ride mode.
So
to me it makes sense that like air ride is the approachable one and City Trial is the more advanced one.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that like that's a good way to approach if you want to like experiment with something or like or you're not confident like that this mode is going to be received well, but you really want to put it in the game anyways, you can have it as a separate mode and then have like the main mode or whatever be another thing.
Right.
I guess that's kind of what shooters do with like single player and multiplayer modes. Because I feel like if I get a shooter, I'm only going to play multiplayer. I don't ever touch the single player.
Right.
But like you can play the single player to like learn about how to play the game and things like that.
Sometimes that's true. And there's a lot of cases where, like in the big franchise games like Call of Duty, I think this is less true probably now than it was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times the single player and multiplayer would be developed by separate studios.
Oh.
And they would have a lot of the same assets, but like sometimes even the mechanics would be slightly different.
Yeah.
In a way that like you could get a sense of multiplayer by playing single player, but you couldn't really use it to train.
Yeah,
like you used to be able to, and it was like literally the exact same, you know, system. Mm-hmm. And I find that sort of interesting. I wonder. It's been a while since I played one of those games, so I don't know what the state of that is now. But I do know that the upcoming Call of Duties are going to be this year's and next year's are going to be focused on single player campaigns.
Oh.
They're going to put a lot of energy into it anyway.
Okay,
which is seems like a bit of a turn.
Yeah,
sort
That's
of
pretty different.
Yeah, I don't know. But then a lot of times these things can turn into spin-offs,
yeah.
Right? So like Gwent, the Witcher card game.
Oh, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
That is really interesting. I know when Dale played through Witcher 3, she spent most of her time playing Gwent.
Oh.
And complaining about it. But but like,
have you seen my Gwent card?
Right, that's what she said. She's like, Geralt should just introduce him by saying, hi, you might remember me from my Gwent card.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing about Gwent that's so weird is like, not that that character isn't famed in his world, but like in the universe of The Witcher, there is a card of him that he plays at tournaments.
Yeah.
Like, and the people of those tournaments are like, oh, that's a good card you just played. Like,
they don't recognize that it's the
right.
same
and kid. There are cards of like all of his friends and family. Like,
yeah.
It's this weird meta disconnect. But I think because that in particular, like games like Hearthstone, which is a World of Warcraft spinoff.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Mm hmm.
And a lot of other digital card games tend to be attached to other IP.
Children's card games. We'll decide this the way we decide every problem. By playing the card game. Okay, go. Keep going. Sorry. You can cut that out. It's just me talking. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Keep
going. I'm clear to continue.
Yes. Sorry.
Right.
And that seems like a weird use of your development time. Have like a totally different game.
Yeah. Two games in one.
Yeah. And that maybe that's just the providence of AAA. Like as an indie, can you, because there's some value to it, like having a totally separate experience. And I guess that's the point I want to make, is to not be so cynical about some of these things. Because it's very easy to be like, oh, it was just they have nothing to do with each other, but like they can inform each other in terms of your overall experience.
Yeah.
And so but the Witcher 3 one is a little strange because it definitely was. You could tell what their plans were.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
They're like almost testing the waters in a way. Maybe it's a safe way to do that as well.
Yeah, it's a bit conflicting too, because like when you're working on an extra mode, that's time spent away from, you know, the base game.
Yeah. And a great example of that is my favorite side mode from Smash, Subspace Emissary.
Ah, yes.
Which is really the only thing I like about Smash.
yeah, they spent a lot of time on that mode, and you can tell, it shows.
Yeah, and like the gameplay is good, mm-hmm. but it's like it was all the cutscenes and like narrative design that actually was like the huge effort. And I loved that. And that was my first Smash experience. Like I'd played it, but it's the first time I owned a copy of Smash was on the Wii. And
yeah.
And I loved that mode. And then when it came out for Wii U and had nothing like that at all.
Right.
And nobody cared. I was just like, is it just me? Like, I loved that mode.
Yeah.
And I liked the side scrolly. I liked those mechanics in a side scroller environment. That was really cool. Even though it was a little weird. And so the World of Light from the latest,
right?
It's
yeah.
a whole. I was hoping it was going to be like Subspace Emissary.
I thought it
was not the case at all.
Yeah,
it's very very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. You've got opinions on that?
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, I liked the mode. It just felt kind of grindy after a while because there's just so many fights, and a lot of them are the same. so like, eventually, it just felt like they just stuffed a bunch of content into this thing. But basically, like you fight against like spirits of previous Nintendo characters and also Metal Gear, I guess.
It never makes sense to me, but
yeah, it's weird. And you fight as like a fight against like a representation of that character. I'm having a hard time coming up. Oh, like I guess one of them is like Cap'n from Animal Crossing. You fight against like one of the Koopalings in a car because I guess Cap'n drive stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's a weird way of bringing these millions of other side characters into the game without actually doing it.
Yeah.
Which to me, it always struck me as kind of strange and kind of like seeing the seams.
The most ambitious crossover in video game history.
Well, I like that concept, and I really liked it because it felt like it was like the event mode from previous Smash games.
And those things were expressed mechanically, which is interesting.
Yeah, and that was really cool. It's just that like there was just so many fights, and they were all started to feel the same. That like it just became a grind.
Almost as if they were assembled programmatically. Rather than handcrafted.
It felt like that in a lot of cases. Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, I imagine there are so many Nintendo characters that some of them overlap, at least. So there was probably that, too.
Right. Like there's, you know, Green Mario, for example.
Right. Exactly that. But like they spent a lot of time on that World of Light mode, and they spent a lot of time on, because there's so many characters in that game as you could play as well as, you know, fight in the spirits and stuff. They spent all of their time on that they had to take out a lot of the older modes that they used to have in every one of them. Like even Home Run Contest that has been in the game since Melee.
Right. And that's almost just put in almost as tradition.
Yeah.
Like, no one loves that mode.
Yeah. I mean, people they compete in it every once in a while, but like it's always been a side thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like they didn't put that in, and they didn't put like Target Smash and stuff like that, like old staples that they used to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I don't know, like, yeah, there's a lot less extra modes in this new Smash as a result of all of the...
Just how big stuff. That one other mode is.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, it can take up a lot of development time.
Right.
So, it's something to consider.
I guess. And I suppose, I mean, I don't know how much Smash suffered for it, but, like, Sakurai probably suffered well for it.
Oh, yeah, he always does.
I guess I want to sort of get into... like games that you guys are making or thinking of making.
Yeah.
Because I have thoughts on the games I'm developing and what I would want to do for this.
Sure.
But I want to hear what you guys think and like what you're doing for Fingence, for example.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in Fingence, we have a time trial mode already in.
Mm-hmm.
I think Charles and Lane just worked on it because they do that sometimes. They'll just work and then like I'll blink and then there's a new mode in the game. I'll be like, what? And we've been talking about having a boss rush thing in the game too, where you just fight against bosses, because code wise it shouldn't be that difficult. We just need UI for it, really.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I think indie developers tend to, and I'm not guessing how you guys have handled this,
sure.
But I think a lot of times there's two sides to it. There's a design element, like, oh, we're doing this, and then we want to have this play off against it or whatever. And then there's like, oh, we've already got these pieces. We can build this pretty easily.
Yeah.
And like, that's not always a bad motivation.
Yeah.
Right? It can be.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times it can lead to inspiration, or it is an effective use of your resources to focus your design thinking that way.
Yeah.
But it's not always as easy as just deciding what to do.
Right. 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 Yeah. Yeah. With Boss Rush, I think a lot of it is because like in Fingence, the bosses are a core part of the gameplay. Like you kind of go through the level to get to the boss. Prevent yourself from taking damage so you can survive longer against the boss. And so it made sense for the game to add a boss rush mode into it. So we haven't added it in yet, but like we've always been saying we're going to do
it. I'm kind of two minds about that because a boss rush, I think, would be a ton of fun.
Yeah.
But at the same time, because the levels in your game are designed as anticipation for the boss, the game is already kind of a boss rush game.
Yeah.
Already.
That's fair.
So the question then is, does having just a boss rush mode distract from of the game entirely in a sense? Like, is it just a variation on the same thing, or is it truly a different mode?
That's a good point I didn't consider.
Like, I don't have an answer to that, but I think it's something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Because you might end up having players who just prefer the boss rush mode, and that becomes the mode of the game that people prefer.
Yeah.
And then your messaging has to either change or adapt.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe you want it to sort of go out and then let everyone who plays it decide what it is.
Yeah.
You know, instead of being so draconian about exactly.
Yeah, that. Yeah. I'm not sure. That's something I hadn't considered before. I'm glad you brought that up. Hmm. Martha, what would you want to put in your game?
Well, I don't know if there'd be anything in my point and click game, but We did talk about adding different modes in Clawbreaker. We ultimately decided not to do any of those because we didn't want to do any more development there. But
that was an effective use of your resources, and that you didn't spend any of them.
Yes. But yeah, we had thought of making like a single player mode where you would fight against an AI crab, or making more crabs so that you'd like fight a bunch of different types of crabs in the single player. Be like, you know, like a hermit crab or like a one of those crabs with the really big claws.
Introduce new mechanics, right?
Yeah, to make it more interesting to do single player Lee. But ultimately, we decided not to do that because it would have required way too much extra work. But like maybe in Clawbreaker 2, Crustacean Combat.
Yes. Yeah, something like that would be cool. Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of things you could do with Clawbreaker that would give it, you know, extra depth.
I think what's interesting about Clawbreaker is because what it is now is a very simple one-on-one fighting game. If you did go for a sequel, it could be anything. Yep. Like, there's nothing that it has to be. Like, it doesn't even have to include a one-on-one fighting mode. Like, it would be a perfectly serviceable sequel with a totally different concept as long as there were crabs fighting in some capacity.
That's true.
It's very true, yeah.
And I think about that, too. Like Mario kind of works that way, where, like, the Captain Toad treasure tracker was a mode in Super Mario 3D World, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then it became its own game.
Yes.
And a lot of that is because the Mario games are so open to just having brand new mechanics. Mm-hmm. Like Yoshi, it's the same deal. Yoshi was just a mechanic that Miyamoto wanted way back in the first Mario Brothers, and then got it into Mario World, and then they're like, well, let's make the whole sequel about Yoshi.
Yeah.
And then now Yoshi has a million games. And so, you know, a thousand flowers bloom or whatever. And I think that's really interesting. So you almost want to be a little bit leave enough open-ended thoughts, I suppose. That doesn't really help you when you're making your game now to think about the 50th game you're going to make, but like it is fun to imagine, you know, like put a kernel of an idea in there, and then even if it's not a complete idea, its existence, it can blossom, right, to stretch the metaphor a bit.
Yeah.
And like it also gives players they can imagine too, even if they don't get the experience. It can be, and you don't have the resources to put 10 fully fleshed modes. If you have a couple little extra things, but then there's the argument that is just a complete waste of time. And I don't know, That's how I feel about Widget Satchel, because Widget Satchel, we have the one single player campaign. That's all we care about now.
Yep.
But we have co-op planned, and that's definitely coming. How soon is the question? Mm-hmm. But then the other thing, and I probably talked about on the show before, is the idea I had for a 4-player competitive mode.
Yeah.
Which is it just takes place in the universe of Widget Satchel.
Yeah.
But I keep thinking about it as being important to it in a weird way. Mm. And so so Widget Satchel's, you know, it's got a lot to it. But if you haven't heard me talk about it before, it's 2D platformer. That's all you really need to know.
Yeah.
But I had this idea for one of the things you do, and we just had you knock junk all over the place. And I thought it would be really cool to have a game mode where you knock junk into something like it's a basketball game or something. Because we did talk about how like you would get mischief points if you were able to like knock something far away, and we have some of that in the game. But that got me thinking about the nature of junk in this space and how that felt a core part of what Widget Satchel is, even if it's not expressed explicitly in the mechanics for how well you do in the game. And so it made me think of like, oh, it'd be great if the four human characters were like a 2-on-2 basketball game called Junk Basket, where you knock junk into an incinerator. Like, and that nothing feels more Widget Satchel to me than that, even though the mechanics have nothing to do with what Widget Satchel is.
Yeah.
But in my mind, it's like an important part of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if we had a larger development team that was getting paid on the regular, like it'd be something I would actually push for in initial release. Not just sort of extend it, but to give players a fuller view of the world that it takes place in, I guess. And even though mechanically it's utterly different. And so when I think about that, and that makes me much more charitable to these weird side projects that just pop up in games that like you don't touch very much.
And
why are they even there?
Yeah.
It's like, so I think that is sometimes the reason that other people do it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's good. Like it's like a additional like sort of passion project sort of thing.
Yeah.
That you're adding into it.
And it can be more than just about expressing the mechanics. It'll be about the world, the characters, the feel, right?
Yeah.
That's what we always talk about when we try to teach game design to people. It's like, mm-hmm. you don't want someone to, like, the goal isn't to get a million points.
Yeah.
The goal is to feel like a winner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And so the how you do that, how you express that mechanically is not always so obvious.
Right.
And sometimes you come at it from different ways. And mm-hmm. and you can come at it from really different ways, mm-hmm. I guess, with these sort of extra modes.
Yeah.
And the last thing I wanted to talk about is Metro Nexus, because that's been on the shelf for a long time.
Yeah.
But the thing about Metro Nexus is I've been developing it for the past couple of years as a multiplayer game and playtesting it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it started out as a single player game. And my vision for it is still 1-to-1, half single player, half multiplayer. I feel like the game cannot, in my mind, it cannot work without both of those, having equal prominence. But reality steps in, right? Like how, and I've thought about it, like, do I release it just as a multiplayer game, then add a single player later? And if I do that, then haven't I already lost the battle for what it is?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. But like it, I think for an indie developer, it does come down to like, how much time you have for your main core experience and how much time you have for experimentation and how important that is to your ultimate vision.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when do you cut back on what it is and versus what it can be? And I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that extends even to AAA games. They have to consider this. There's just way more people
to
consider it and way more people to work on the thing.
Right.
If you're just sitting around not doing anything, you can work on an extra mode on the site.
Yeah.
But yeah, like those are things to consider about it. Like they can add a lot for the game, both like, you know, in the game itself and also for like the players. They can experience more of it and they can spend more time with the game. But is it necessarily worth the extra resources you have to allot to add it in?
Yeah, like the sailing a boat in Assassin's Creed 3 was worth the extra time,
mm-hmm.
even though it was a little different from what you thought of an Assassin's Creed game.
Mm-hmm.
But adding checkers to Assassin's Creed 3, not a good use of their time.
Yeah.
That's sort of what I think.
Yeah.
So the open world games with tons of mini games, I feel... they lose on both counts.
Yeah.
They feel like it's a waste of the player's time, it's a waste of the developer's time, and it doesn't add anything to the sort of like the feel of the game or like the richness of its experience. It's just more to do.
Well, if the feel of the game is more to do.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, and this is just my opinion.
Yeah.
Like, I think I feel like people have reasonably disagree with that.
Sure.
And that's fair.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I feel like that's the worst way to do these extra modes is just to like dump them all over the world, you know, like playing darts or going bowling or like having like races, you know, like a lot of that just feels like it does feel so extra in a derogatory sense, I suppose. Martha, you disagree?
You're basic. It's a human insult. You're devastated right now. Anyway, I mean, like in GTA, there's a bunch of mini game things you can do, which like are, I think there are some that are like, why, like arm wrestling, why is this in here? But then like racing is pretty fun. And then people have taken that, like there's some sort of way you can build mods and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's these videos that I watch of Achievement Hunter guys trying to like use the cars to like drive and do these races that are like across buildings and stuff like that. And it's like super cool.
Yeah.
And all the extra modes that you play, if you're trying to like run, do a, like a pacifist run in a violent
then
video game, then you have things to do to get money and you can get around the violent stuff.
There you go. And I think with that, maybe what it is, and where I get closer to being on board with that kind of stuff, is that it lets the player decide what it is a little bit more.
Yeah.
If the developer is basically does not have an opinion on the fact. The racing makes a lot of sense, like the things you do with it, because that is closer to the core mechanics of that
game. That's true.
Too.
That's true.
So that's probably a better example than like bowling or darts or whatever.
Yeah.
A lot of times, because these mini modes tend to like not be great games.
Yeah.
You know, they tend to just be there and you sort of put up with it because you're in the middle of an excellent experience otherwise.
But then you have stuff like Spy Fox where mm-hmm. you would play, like we would boot that up just to play the Spy Watch games.
Yeah.
Like there's like, if you pull the Spy Watch up, you could play like a ripoff of Asteroids or like mm-hmm. a ripoff of it was almost like Fingence, one of the games that you played.
I remember you were talking about this. It was like a sub
Little Happy Fun Sub. Yeah. We were a submarine and you would go around, but you could also become an airplane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway.
I think that one's an interesting case because like the Spy Fox games are educational games, right?
Yeah.
So,
so you could get around that by doing.
It's a common grade schooler technique is to find the find the actual just pure fun experience of an educational experience.
That wasn't the angle I was going. But you're right. I was thinking of it more of like like a history of video games sort of thing.
Oh, yeah,
like
that's
true.
Like
you can learn about, knockoff Asteroids is still Asteroids. You can learn about Asteroids.
Yeah.
As a result of that.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Well, putting like retro arcade style games is a common tactic.
Yeah.
Animal Crossing has an NES emulator in
that's
it.
That's right, yeah.
Fallout. You can play games on the Pip-Boy, right? Mm-hmm. I've never done that, but I've heard about it.
Oh, Into the Woods has a game on her laptop you can play that's like a roguelike, and mm-hmm. it's totally separate.
Ah.
And then there's in Stardew Valley, there's an arcade game where it's like a bullet hell sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And... yeah, there's I forgot how many games have something like that.
And like sometimes they're just mini games, but sometimes they really do feel like separate experiences.
Yeah. Donkey Kong 64 had both the original Donkey Kong, like the arcade that had like all of the different levels in it. Now the new ones they always release, they only have like a few of the levels.
Yeah.
And then they had it had Jetpack, because that game was developed by Rare, and Jetpack is a Rare game.
Mm-hmm.
So it had both of those games in there. That was really neat.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right. So sometimes like the extra mode is not always a mode. It's just extra content.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And not always strictly just a mini game, but like an older game embedded or some piece of history that can give you more context on the larger experience you're playing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess there are definitely lots of angles.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. There's a lot of things you can do with extra mods.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because you have all these little things put together, you're going to have to test each one individually. Which brings us to my topic, unit tests.
Ah, is that what a unit test is?
I feel like this is going to be educational for a lot of people.
Me especially.
So, at my job, we have been learning how to do unit tests for all our UI coding and stuff. And I don't know very much about them either. So I am learning myself this stuff. So I wanted to talk about it because I'm like, I don't think like very many game devs unit test or know what that is. Because automated testing is just, seems less practical, in games than just having someone sit down and play it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Because a lot of times you're testing for like, does this feel right? Which you can't really automate. That mm-hmm. unless you have like a feels bot, but then even then that doesn't really mean anything. So what a unit test is you're like, there's all sorts of different automated tests that will run that you can set up to do different things, but a unit test is the smallest type of test you can do, and what you're trying to do is just like test one method or test one part of one method.
Okay.
Like the smallest you can get. So you're just testing one thing. Oh. And then when you add all of those tests together, you get a fuller picture of where your problem points are.
Sure. Okay.
So like, for example, like say you have a method that is like, when you press A, you should jump.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Mm-hmm. So how you would test that is you would write a test that would run just that method and give it an input of I pressed A, even if you didn't you don't actually press A, but you tell the method I just pressed A and then see what it does at the end.
Okay.
And if you have jumped or not.
and a big part of it is of the testing is being able to have conditions that you can actually just read off and did it do it rather than you subjectively looking and seeing if it worked.
Yes,
right?
Yes, okay. Yes.
And so designing that is probably the reason why game developers don't ever do this.
Yes, it is like really hard to get your head around it, especially because it's very opposite of how a like developer thinks about mm-hmm. writing something. Because like, so we use a library for JavaScript, I think it's called Jasmine at my job. And basically this is true for any test. So because you only want to test this one little part, you have to, if it calls anything else, you have to make a mock of it or a like basically a fake version of that, those other calls to feed it back. So it's not actually touching any of the other code. So like, say you have something in your, jump thing that, changes the color of your character also, but you only wanted to check if they jumped, not at what color it was. So when it calls what color am I method, you would give that a fake, you'd at the top of your test file, you'd define a fake one that okay. would give it, would return what the method is expecting it to return.
Okay.
It eliminates, I mean, literally eliminates other variables.
Yes, exactly.
Sure, yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
It's a little confusing.
I guess I'm having a hard time. When would you do this?
Okay, I have a pretty good example of when this might work, because I thought about this a lot when we were doing widgets at Shell, but we could never figure out a testing method to make this happen.
Yeah.
And it is related to jumping.
Okay.
So in widgets at Shell, how heavy your satchel is dependent, it changes how high you can jump. And the way we do this, this is a system that Stephen, you designed, is that we give it a certain impulse, right? Or we feed it numbers as to how high the jump should be.
Right.
And then we calculate what impulse we need to get that high.
Yeah.
If I'm describing it correctly.
That's pretty accurate,
Now, the thing we didn't do was determine how, if you just from a straight jump, how far the sprocket can jump.
Right.
Because that is a function of gravity and speed and how long you are in the air. Mm-hmm. And so, naturally, the faster you are, as you get heavier, you go slower and jump lower. So, you will also, as just a result of that, don't jump as far.
Yeah.
And so what we did is we just like played it a bunch and then like, that's about as far as it goes. So we were deciding like how far to move gaps apart for jumps at different weights. We did that a lot just by checking it out. I desperately wanted to come up with a system where we would actually be able to test to see how far Sprocket actually jumped at those different things.
Yeah.
And we would do that not by calculating it in the method, but by giving it something we expect to happen and seeing if it does or doesn't reach that point. And then we would run that until we found it, until it narrowed in on the result that it did do, and then said yes or no to that. And as far as I understand, that's basically a unit test. But we could never, I didn't make a lot of noise about this, but I really wanted to do it, but I knew it would just take forever to figure out when it would just be faster to just eyeball it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that is an example where you would do that, especially for games that have that are like mechanically rigid and have lots of rules that need to be followed. We could get away with it. But other games that maybe are more need more expected behavior would maybe benefit more from putting in the time to do that.
Sure. So, yeah, Andy and Scott, when they were contracted to work on Treasure Stack, they had it in a unit testing scene in Unity for Treasure Stack. And they used it to like, you know, because when I was working on it, I thought that it was relatively bug fixed or free. is bug free?
You say that as someone who's since learned better.
Yeah. Right. But when Annie and Scott were working on it, they were working on implementing the networking and stuff. So like they had to change a lot of the code in order to get it to work. And so they built a separate scene for unit testing. So they would test to see like how the blocks would react in this scenario and this scenario and this scenario and stuff like that.
Like if there's latency between the things, like what happens, or like if you know the other player does this, does that affect stuff like that.
And that's a much more traditional software development task that more obviously benefits from a testing configuration.
And both of those two are classically trained. They went to school for this, so it makes sense they could they thought of that and were able to implement it. I guess I'm like, I can see the case where it's useful. Like I could see the case where it was useful in Treasure Stack, and I could see the case where it was could be useful in Widget Satchel. And in more especially in more like rule based, this needs to happen when this happens kinds of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just haven't developed
yeah
a game other than Treasure Stack for that yeah. need that. So I haven't really. Like
you know, it's interesting because I think Fingence would benefit from a lot more certainty about what happens when.
Oh?
Right? I mean, there's so many moving parts and flying bullets in that game.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
But I guess the thing is you don't need to do it. It's a different way of working in some cases. There are some scenarios, I think, Martha, you would probably agree, where this is something where it's a it's a just a clear benefit to building, to knowing how this works and building it. And then there's some where you just have to make a judgment call as to whether it's worth the effort, right?
Yes. Yeah, because I think, well, I was looking through Unity documentation specifically, which...
That's your first mistake.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's not mobile friendly either. Hey, Unity. Hey, Unity. Some people look at the documentation on their phone. Just saying. Anyway, and yeah, like, it is dense reading about the Unity test suite. Because, yeah, not only do you have to learn how to do it in Unity, you also have to learn the .NET library that they're using to do the test.
Oh.
So I can see how this is like a bigger hurdle for game devs, especially using Unity, than it is for a software company doing stuff in JavaScript.
Yeah.
If your game is in JavaScript, it's a lot easier because there's a ton more libraries and you don't have to be fighting the engine all the time. Like, that's the one thing that we, like, as I've been learning this at work, it's been difficult to be like, okay, so where am I testing the code I wrote and where am I accidentally testing the library that I'm importing? Because really, I want to be just testing the stuff I wrote, because if the library breaks, that's their problem, and our problem to send in a support ticket for. But I mean, I guess it doesn't matter really, because if the library breaks, it'd be good to know that. But like, what am I trying to say? Yes, it's a really big hurdle to do. I think if you had planned it in the beginning, and knew how to do all of it, it might be really useful, because like, if you're adding an extra mode or you're changing the code to be multiplayer or whatever, that's where these tests come in the most useful. Like, when you're writing the thing, it's like, okay, yeah, I know it's going to jump. Like, I can see it. It did the thing. Why am I even, this is a lot of extra wasted time.
Yeah.
But if you do something that changes something else that method calls, and then suddenly, you know, like
it breaks, and why?
It breaks and you're like, why?
Yeah.
What, like, you can run the test so you can be like, oh, it's failing here and here because, you know, what it's getting like, passed in is like, you know, if you run all the tests together, that's where the value comes in.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And that's something where, and this is where like, I have no knowledge whatsoever, is, you know, but like the libraries, there's sort of a bunch of tools. And that's the reason why I think a lot of us don't do these things, is because we don't have or know the tools. You can write your own from your own, you know, come up with your own ideas to make it work. Unit testing isn't necessarily something you need a tool for, but it's something you definitely want one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like, the one we use at work makes it all very, like, if you speak English anyway, English language friendly, where it's like, when, if something happens, when this is something, this is like this, expect this to happen.
Ah. Oh.
So it's all like very word. It's not the math, it's words.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which I can't say right now, but so having, and I think the one that Unity uses built in, there's lots of like plugins that, like from the asset store, that can help you too, but it's called NUnit, standing for like .NET unit test.
Okay.
They've got a pretty intuitive syntax anyway on building your tests.
I think maybe one of the benefits, or one of the ways to see the value of unit testing, is to familiarize yourself with a tool like that.
Yeah,
the terminology, the language to describe your tasks and pieces and things you do, then you can sort of understand a workflow, and then it doesn't seem so alien, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that would probably help. Like, I just haven't done it, so it's hard for me to. I mean, I guess this is the same with a lot of coding things.
Well, that's the thing. I also don't have this background. So, I'm only saying this because it's true of other things.
Oh, well, that's what I'm saying.
When something seems so foreign and alien and why, that other people swear by it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's just like, oh, if I just, I don't know, read what other people use, even though I know I'm not going to use it, like right now, or then I'll at least have an understanding so that when I do need it, I can come back to it.
Right.
From a better place.
Well, that's a lot of coding things that I just, originally when I hear about them, I'm like, why would I ever need to use this? And then I can come up with plenty of reasons after, like,
once you know what it is.
Well, yeah. Once I know what it is, and once I've had enough experience with things that are not that, I've learned. So I could potentially learn with unit testing as well.
It's a lot of these different sort of sideways topics that you don't come to naturally if you don't have a computer science background. Mm-hmm. It can feel like a, you know, you slap your forehead like, oh, of course, right?
Yeah, I'm just, I mean, as I said before, I'm just learning this stuff too. Mm-hmm. So it's been a real mind trip being like, oh, okay. Yeah, oh, I guess that makes sense. Oh, this is way easier than I thought it was or whatever. I found an example of the ones Unity uses, and it's pretty English language friendly. Mm-hmm. It's like when executed, return success. While utility is running, return null, assert that this is true.
Okay.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
We're nodding over here because we totally get what you're saying.
Yeah, it's hard to talk about this in an audio format because it's so much like, look at this thing. You can't look at it.
Well, I think it'd be nice if we can get a couple of links to maybe some explainer articles. We could just throw maybe one or two at least.
Yes.
And then definitely link to the Unity stuff because I think not a lot of people know where to find those things. Mm-hmm. And then some of the tools you used to get familiar with what brought you into it.
Yeah. I definitely will link all those in the show notes. One thing that I was, so my dad was a software tester for his job before I retired. And he got me this book called Testing Computer Software Second Edition. And I haven't read the whole thing yet, but it's been super interesting reading about it. And helping me get in the mindset to write these tests at work. And I was learning something really interesting in one of the first chapters that is helpful even if you're not writing unit tests. Mm-hmm. Because if you're gonna, there's these things called like testing boundaries, mm-hmm. where you want to test, instead of testing all the numbers 1 through 99, if you're like looking to see if someone input the right thing or whatever, you just test at the edges of these test cases. So like you were like, okay, does it work with single numbers? Does it work with numbers with two digits? Does it work with decimal numbers? So you just test right where those categories change,
yeah,
instead of all the numbers.
Yeah.
So like if you're playtesting something or you're just like testing to make sure something worked in the editor or whatever, like don't try all the things. Just try things that would be right at the edge of what you're expecting.
Right. And hopefully if you are testing something small enough where there's no variables that pop up in between.
Yes. Yeah.
or different conditions, then yeah, then you complete your test a lot sooner.
Yes. Like
optimizing what you test for.
And the other good thing that they said in this book was that there's no such thing as 100% tested code. Like you'll always have bugs and there will always be parts that you don't know. So like if you hear of anybody saying that our code is 100% tested and you're like, that's BS. So like if this is something that sounds way too complicated for you or whatever, don't worry about it. But it's something interesting to look into, yeah. I think.
Mm-hmm.
Something to consider.
Yeah. I think the trickiest part for game developers is the knowing when to use it.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is more than you are now, probably, right? For all of us.
Yeah.
But where is that limit? You know, when does it become too much? And that's true of a lot of other topics, of course.
That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app and be sure to give it a good review if you liked it or are nice like us. We really do need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club.
And talk to Dale.
Right, yes, Dale is now our Twitter manager.
Yeah.
She's doing a great job already.
She took up the task with more gusto than maybe we're super comfortable with.
Yeah. Actually, before the show, she was taking pictures of us, like, fake recording.
Yeah. But the benefit is that
you... Real recording. Ruin the magic, Steven.
Of course. We're always recording.
But you can expect now some tweets from us.
Yeah.
Which is better than any of us had managed up to now. So...
Yeah. Yes, it'll be great. I'm looking forward to it. She also made a thing. Was it Feedback Friday?
Yeah, she had this idea that we've been trying to get people to give us feedback on the feedback form. Where can they find that?
Nicegames.club/feedback.
That's right. And we bang that drum and laugh the whole way because it's difficult. It's difficult to get people to commit to giving us their thoughts. I have to say, the people who have, like, thank you so much.
Yes.
Like, it's been really valuable to hear those things. One, it's nice to hear we're doing well. Mm-hmm. And also, it's nice to hear, like, what you want to hear more of and maybe what you want to hear a little less of. we want to hear that stuff. Anyway, but Dale knows that we talk about how we always want to try to get more feedback. And that's, as game developers, it's a huge thing that matters to us. And so she's like, well, let's do a thing, Feedback Friday. So she's going to be trying to promote that. So when you see those tweets from us, or even when you just know it's Friday, go ahead and tweet with that, hashtag Feedback Friday. Show off something you're designing, like an A-B test of two different illustrations, or a piece of code that you can say, hey, is this, do you think this will do the job? Like, or a video that says, what do you think of the feel of this? Or, you know, anything. Like, we want to hear how we're doing whatever you're making. Sometimes the people around you can't give you a lot of time to give you all the feedback you need. And a lot of times you certainly can't, pay for, a lot of QA testing.
Right. Yeah.
And so sometimes just a casual, just little extra effort on Twitter, and all the, hopefully we can all engage with each other and even better, see the cool stuff you're making.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So look forward to all that. It'll be great.
Yeah.
Follow us on this journey. you can also email us at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find out more about the show and your nice hosts, as well as get all of the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice. Documentation, please load. Unity, you're the worst.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.